You know, here on No Nonsense Nutrition, you hear me say many times that there's always a challenge of what it is I'm going to offer every week. And we mix it up. You know, I do a little bit about food and a little bit about treatment and a little bit about what's happening out there in the world, especially in the world of toxins. But I have to tell you, this week I'm angry. And when you hear that voice, you know, usually when you say angry, your voice goes up instead of going down. But I'm angry, deep angry. And the kind of angry I am right now is at an illusion. The illusion that the FDA is protecting us from bad drugs, bad food. When I look at the FDA and I wonder if it means failure to do anything, I really am beset with the news that came out this week about the diabetes drug Avandia. And so right now you might be saying, well, Eve, I don't take Avandia and I don't have diabetes. And so this show is not going to be about me. I got news for you. This show is exactly going to be about you. Not only because of the fact that diabetes is affecting more and more people here in the United States, but what's true is very few of us move into the 7th, 8th, and 9th decades without having some sort of pharmaceutical on board. You know, I'm not against pharmaceutical drugs. Pharmaceutical drugs have saved my life, and I know there's lots of listeners out there that they've saved their life as well. But I'm pretty upset about the fact that big agri, big food, and big pharma have the FDA in their pocket. And this chronically overworked and underfunded FDA doesn't appear to have either the means or the inclination to protect consumers, to protect you, to protect me, to protect your kids from the monstrous three-headed hydra of big agriculture, big food, and big pharma. And I roll them all together because they are all together. You know, when I was writing my column for Natural Awakenings yesterday, I was trying to give specific factoids, as always. And there was a really interesting study that was done recently where they evaluated 12 hours of Saturday morning television and 84 hours of prime time television and just made a list of all the foods that were promoted. And if you ate just the foods that were promoted on television, you would get 25 times the recommended daily allowance for sugar, 25 times, and 20 times the recommended daily allowance for fats. And that would be in a 2,000 calorie diet. So you would get as much sugar in one day as we think you should get in a month. And so when we look at that, that is what is driving illness in this country. We are eating miserable, lousy, non-nutritive foods that are creating the very health problems that are causing us to need the pharmaceuticals in the first place. So when we realize that oil goes to chemicals and chemicals goes to pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides, chemicals go to pharmaceuticals, chemicals go to additives in the food, we can see that the tri-headed hydra of big ag, big food, and big pharma are really three faces of the same monster. They're not a monster that's designed to make you healthier. You know, if the food industry is spending over $11 billion a year to promote those foods, and then the United States Department of Agriculture is spending $256 million to promote eating broccoli and fresh fruit, then we're outgunned. And then we're outgunned big time. You're being deluged with messages that every kind of frosty French fry, sugar-coated bomb that's out there is really food. And it's not, and you knew it wasn't. And you go, but Eve, it tastes so good. Once. And I say once because the caboose is going to come up and whack you. when I see individuals that show up in my office and what they've done is they've abused themselves for 40 or 50 or 60 years, and then they expect to find a pill to fix it. And whether they expect to find that pill at their physician's office, or they expect to find it in my office because it's going to be an herb, or it's going to be a homeopathic remedy, or it's going to be a nutraceutical that's going to fix the problem. And yet, they haven't really addressed the foundational change that is necessary, which is to start to eat real food. You know, when I say to people, all you have to do is look at the food and ask yourself the question, does it occur in nature? This ain't rocket science. You know, here's a chicken, here's a chicken nugget, here's a potato, here's a Pringle. You don't need a PhD in nutrition to tell the difference between real food and this plastic, fantastic, modified, low vitality jive that keeps getting put on our plate. And so it motivates the creation of disease. Well, look at the profits. We drive profits that way. We make sure that we feed people food that's going to assure that they will get sick so that we can sell them drugs that are not designed to cure them. They're designed for you to be on them forever and ever. Amen. You know, I have once a month a guest on No Nonsense Nutrition, Dr. William Frederick Harvey, an internist and gerontologist here in Sarasota, who walks with me along the holistic trail. And I had a conversation with him the other day about the fact that he read in Internal Medicine that a new report that showed that PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, these things that suppress stomach acid, actually become addictive. And I have to put addictive in quotes here. Addictive in terms of the fact that when people went off of them, they got very serious episodes of heartburn. And you say, well, Eve, people only go on acid-suppressing medicine if they have heartburn in the first place. No, there are other reasons for people to go on acid-suppressive medicine besides having reflux. So perhaps they're put on that drug by their physician for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 8 weeks. But when they come off of it, they get symptoms that they never had before. So, of course, it makes them want to take more of it. And so we create a cycle where a drug was supposedly rightly used in the first place and then becomes so much a part of a person's day that they don't think anything about the fact that they're going to stop by the drugstore on the way home and pick up the large economy size of Pepcid, Axid, Prilosec, Propulsid, Maalox, Alka-Seltzer. I mean, you know, there's a thousand of compounds out there, but specifically the drug that is now on the over-the-counter market as a proton pump inhibitor. Remember, when you suppress stomach acid is there to do two things. First off, it's there to sterilize your food, a thing that very few people recognize. Most people recognize that stomach acid is there to help you digest your food. But frankly, it's just there to help you digest your protein. Stomach acid doesn't work on an apple or a piece of toast. It fundamentally works on the pork chop and the chicken and the salmon and the egg. Works on proteins. But when you lose the ability to sterilize your food, then critters that are on your food can end up inoculating your bowel. You can end up getting food poisoning, or you can end up actually colonizing in your bowel bacteria that don't belong there because normally they would have been killed by your stomach acid. But we know now that people that are on proton pump inhibitors and other kinds of acid suppressors, there's another category called H2 blockers, histamine receptor site 2 blockers. When people are on these drugs for 6 months and longer, they actually increase the risk of hip fracture because you're also supposed to absorb your minerals in the acid environment of your digestion. And so if you've suppressed that acid environment, then you don't break your minerals out of your food in the same way. So it's currently believed that that's the reason that we see increased risk of fracture in individuals that are on stomach acid suppressors. So first off, you don't digest your protein well, which not only can create a pretty gnarly environment in the plumbing downstairs. Remember, undigested protein gives a stinky gas. Everybody's got gas, but I'm talking about what we call in the clinic the have mercy gas when we don't digest our protein correctly. We end up increasing our risk of bone loss. we end up increasing our risk of food poisoning and colonizing a critter in the bowel. Oh, this just really looks like a divine list, doesn't it? Now, there are very special places where these drugs are appropriate. If somebody has an ulcer in their stomach, then using acid suppressant drugs for 4 weeks or 8 weeks is really a very ideal strategy to allow that ulcer to heal. And then, of course, you have to look at the foundational diet to find out why somebody got an ulcer in the first place, because we know now that ulcers are not caused by nerves. That, for the most part, ulcers are caused by a bacteria called H. pylori or Helicobacter pylori. And so the breath test or the stool study for H. pylori bacteria is the very first thing that somebody should do before they go on a drug that is a stomach acid suppressor. I'm learning just recently that the antibody test that's done in the blood for H. pylori bacteria is not really terribly accurate. It's not terribly responsive to a subtle infection of H. pylori. So what does that all mean? It means if you got heartburn, if you got reflux, and you're popping a Rolaids, a Tums, an Alka-Seltzer, a baking soda, put in water, and it just happened on occasion because you were, you forgot that the last time you had a pineapple pizza and a chocolate shake that it gave you indigestion. And so you do it again and you get indigestion. That's an intermittent kind of thing. And that's fundamentally found by looking in the rearview mirror and asking, what did I eat before I got heartburn, and figuring out that that combination didn't work very well for you. But even if you did get a true effect of GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, or heartburn, or reflux, or sour rising, and you went on one of these kinds of drugs, it shouldn't be every day, every day, every day. Because otherwise, you got an underlying problem. And whether it's H. pylori or whether it's lousy food, you need to look at the originating source. But again, we're so interested in just taking a pill. So I had a new client a couple of weeks ago, and he happened to be on one of these PPIs, these proton pump inhibitors. And when I looked at his list of drugs, he was polypharmacy, many drugs. And I told him, I said, my license as a nutrition counselor does not allow me to tell you to come off a drug a doctor has prescribed. The only thing that I can tell you is that if you were my brother and you were taking this particular compound, this looks like the compound that would be the easiest to get off. And so I looked at his particular list, and I saw that this stomach acid suppressing drug was on this list, and it seemed like the simplest one that he might be able to eliminate. And he turned to me absolutely straight-faced, and he said, yeah, but if I eliminate that, I won't be able to eat pepperoni pizza. And I was absolutely dumbstruck when I heard that. I won't be able to eat pepperoni pizza. I have to keep taking the drug so I can eat pepperoni pizza. Never once had it crossed his mind that, in fact, eating the pepperoni pizza might not really be very good for him. So he was going to take a drug to allow him to continue to take a food that wasn't right for him. It reminded me of what happened when the red wine study came out. When the French paradox was revealed, that people could in France were eating a fairly high-fat diet with lots of cheeses and pâtés, etc., but if they drank red wine, they didn't have the same rate of heart disease that we saw in America. And so it suddenly gave people permission to start slugging down red wine. And they left out a huge big piece of the nature of the French culture. First off, the French rarely are eating their meals on TV trays in front of the news of the war zone. We have to remember that when we consume everything in our environment. And so if you're eating at the same time that you're consuming the bombs and bodies, then believe me, it will affect your psyche in some way. But Americans, eating is not an event. Eating is something you do before the event. You eat dinner and then you go to the movie. You eat dinner and then you go to the play. You eat dinner and then you go do something. Oftentimes in France, dinner is the evening. It is the social camaraderie. It is the exchange that takes place. And the exchange is not, get your hands off your sister. It's not the screaming fights that we see depicted in all too many American dining rooms every single solitary night. So people read this study about the French paradox, gave themselves permission to continue to eat the steak and the fries and the cheesecake and just wash it all down with a big old glug of Merlot, and that would solve the problem. We're not looking at the underlying causatives. So anybody who watches television, anybody who surfs the internet, anybody who flips through a magazine is very familiar with advertising for pharmaceutical drugs that always picture attractive, healthy, and active people. There was a comic on Comedy Central the other night that was given some very intelligent comedy, really reminded me a lot of Mort Saul, for those of you who remember Mort Saul. And he was talking about the fact that herpes is probably caused by windsurfing, rollerblading, beach volleyball, and you get the drift. What happened was that every advertisement for a drug that was going to treat herpes had somebody out there being really active doing all of these, you know, windsurfing, rollerblading, beach volleyball kinds of activities. And there was an ultimate irony that was there. As he was saying, so if somebody invites you on a date and they ask you to go out windsurfing or rollerblading, you got to be careful. Well, the poignant humor that was placed in that was the same kind of irony that we see in a lot of pharmaceutical drugs picturing attractive, healthy, and active people. They never show you somebody sick actually taking the drug. Prescription and over-the-counter drugs are used by millions of consumers for various ailments, for diseases, for medical conditions. And for most, the prescription drugs can provide benefit or relief. But the consequence of the development of many drugs and the marketing to millions of consumers are serious side effects or other undesired results. In extreme cases, the USDA may actually withdraw the drug, and the hearing, I believe, is going to take place today about whether Avandia is going to come off the market. The only problem with the Avandia story is the fact that the warnings on Avandia were originally published in 2002. Excuse me, 2002? Do you know how many tens of thousands of people have died as a result of Avandia staying on the market for the last 8 years? We know that it's linked to a greater risk of heart attack and possibly death, a 43% higher risk of heart attack, a 64% greater risk of cardiovascular death. When we look at the history of the FDA being notified about Avandia's problems going back now 8 years, and the only thing that they did was put a warning out. You know, they sent out a warning. And it was interesting. I asked Dr. Harvey about the way that physicians get notified. And he said that, you know, the drug companies are required to go ahead and send out a notification to physicians when, you know, there's a problem. Well, they turn around and send that notice out when there's a problem. And at the same time, they send out all the notices that say there really isn't a problem. You know, it's a situation where the promotion is taking place at the same time that the warning is, because they get the letter from the FDA, and in the same mail they get the advertisements from GlaxoSmithKline or whoever that's the manufacturers of Avandia, by the way, these studies are actually flawed and there's nothing the matter with the drug. Well, go back a dozen years, actually 13 years to be exact, when the FDA approved Regulin. And that was the first drug in that category, in that class of drugs, that was designed to help the body use insulin more appropriately. And 2.5 years later, the FDA okayed Avandia, and about 2 months after that, it approved Actos. So all three of these drugs were approved in that period of time between January of 97 and July of 99. But in March of 2000, 3 years later, the FDA actually had to withdraw Resulin because it was more toxic to the liver than either Avandia or the third drug in that category, Actos. But by the time that we got to April of 2002, so dig it, this is 8+ years ago, there were new warnings about an increased risk of heart failure. GlaxoSmithKline and the FDA notified doctors of new or worsening diabetic macular edema. Now, you know that the macula is the center part of your vision. You've heard of macular degeneration. So right in the very center part of your vision, when you look at the eye and you see the macula, it's the color of an egg yolk because that's the same fats that are in there. Diabetic macular edema. The eye gets fluid in it, and so we get vision impairment. So 5 years ago, GlaxoSmithKline had to notify doctors, oop, we got another problem here. We don't just have an increased risk of heart failure, we also have an increased of diabetic macular edema. Well, 3 years ago, they sent out a letter, Glaxo sends out a letter that says, Dear Healthcare Professional, saying a clinical trial found a, quote, significantly higher risk of fracture in women who took Avandia compared with those who got other drugs, older diabetes medications like metformin. Okay, now we have an increased risk of heart failure, we have diabetic macular edema, and we have a higher risk of fracture. Now, all of this stuff is in ink over a 5-year period of time. Well, finally, they put out some warnings about this. When we look at 07, by the time we got to 07, the New England Journal of Medicine says that Avandia increased the risk of heart attacks. It wasn't simply heart failure, it was also heart attacks. And yet, when this was brought to committee at the FDA, the committee members voted 20-3 that Avandia did increase heart risks. Back in 07, 20-3, it's risky. But then they voted 22-1 that the drug's risk-benefit profile merited it staying on the drugstore shelves. So even though it could kill you, it had some benefits. The panelists who voted in favor of keeping Avandia on the market suggested a variety of labeling changes, including what's called a black box warning about the effect on heart attack risk and other contraindications. And, you know, GlaxoSmithKline said, we welcome this decision as positive for patients. Excuse me, you're selling a drug that's killing people. And we accept this ruling as positive for patients, meaning it got to stay on the market. So when the chief of cardiovascular medicine at Cleveland Clinic pooled the results of 43 different clinical trials, he found that the patients were 43% more likely to have a heart attack or be hospitalized for blocked coronary arteries as a result of taking Avandia. So when you hear me say I'm angry, I'm not even angry that the drug didn't work. I'm not even angry that GlaxoSmithKline tried to make money on this drug. Guess what Big Pharma is supposed to do? What I'm angry about is that the Failure to Do Anything agency, the FDA, has had this information now for 8 years, and these, you got to watch your language on the radio. These individuals who served on these panels said, oh, well, there's still a big benefit for this drug, so we ought to let it stay on the market. Well, yeah, $3.2 billion in sales, that's a pretty big benefit, all right. So we're going to have, class action suits against GlaxoSmithKline as a result of Avandia. I mean, their sales plummeted after these releases came out earlier this year. But now with this new, absolutely incontrovertible statement, they're going to plummet more. But you see, my issue really is about you. About two things about you. Number one, if you continue to have the belief that you can break all of the rules and do that for 40 or 60 or 80 years and then go find a pill that's going to solve your problem, then you need to think again. And the other thing is, this is only one drug. Yasmin birth control. Yasmin birth control was first put on the market in the United States in 2001. And they sold $500 million worth of birth control pills last year. But when you get to the whoops, Yasmin is associated with an increased risk of myocardial infarct, thromboembolism, stroke, hepatic neoplasia, gallbladder disease, hypertension, mood swings, depression, weight gain, edema. Because the way that these two synthetic hormones in here, the synthetic estrogen and the synthetic progesterone. Remember, progesterone is the natural hormone. Progestin is the synthetic version. Well, it works against the body's normal mechanism for regulating salt and water balance. And that salt water balance can lead to potentially serious heart problems in some patients. But that didn't make the front page. There's that weight loss product that's over there on the over-the-counter category, Ally, as properly called. I had a client that came in recently, and she said she wanted the Ally, the Hawaiian weight loss drug. So it is marketed in the U.S. as well as Zenical. These are popular weight loss supplements. Well, now the FDA has made an announcement that there were reports of serious liver injury, including cases of liver failure. I got news for you. When you have liver failure, one of two things happen. Either, if you're really, really lucky, you're on the liver transplant list, and oh, don't you think that's a whole lot of fun to go through. You're on the liver transplant list, and because you've got plenty of money and you got plenty of insurance and you happen to be one of the ones that you get a good donor match for, you end up getting a liver before you absolutely turn the color of mustard. Or you go to that big liver recycling place in the sky. In other words, you croak. So now you've got an individual who's trying to lose weight, and they're going to go to the drugstore, and they're going to buy a weight loss supplement, or they're going to go to the doctor and they're going to get Orlistat, which is the prescription drug Zenical, and they end up with yellowing of the eyes, yellowing of the skin, abdominal pain, you know, darkening of the urine, other signs of liver damage. Well, I guarantee you they're going to lose a lot of weight then. Having seen what individuals go through that get a liver transplant, I would suggest that maybe we try another weight loss protocol. Oh, well, that's not all there is. That's not all there is. We got a terrific drug. Ah, terrific drug. Another drug that's used in disorders like heartburn. Reglan. Well, there is a black box warning on Reglan. When we look at tardive dyskinesia, not something that easily is said in conversation. These are involuntary repetitive motions. When we look at, I'm sure you've seen at some point, one of the 1,000-year-old men that's here in Sarasota walking down the street and thrusting his tongue out repeatedly. And I'm going to target men in this particular instance because I saw one of these day before yesterday. That involuntary repetitive movement, or twitch, is tardive dyskinesia. Well, Reglan, a drug that is used for heartburn, can cause this twitch to happen. The problem is that long after the patient stops using the drug, it can still be going on. So even if somebody develops this, and you know how attractive it is to have your tongue thrust out every 4 seconds, they stop the drug, the problem doesn't go away. And it was really interesting because they said any patients that were taking Reglan or any other form of this particular compound should be warned of the risk by their doctor. Right. So you thought it was safe to go back in the water again, didn't you? And then we find out that Johnson & Johnson, I don't know about you, but, you know, I still remember that No More Tears shampoo. I'm thinking these really are the good guys. No More Tears shampoo, they're taking care of babies. You know, they're making sure that everything is okay. You know, I grew up with the idea of Johnson & Johnson was, they were kind of like the really friendly little doctor next door. Well, that might be true, and you might think of babies. Oh, well, if babies are sick, we should go give the kid Pediacare. You know, Pediacare is one of those drinks that you buy packaged that you can give your kid if it's got diarrhea. Well, it turns out that they were recalled last month. The plant was shut down because tiny particles have been found in the Pediacare products. So just when you thought it was safe to treat your baby by Johnson & Johnson, it turns out that they had to pull back Tylenol infant drops, children's Tylenol suspensions, children's Tylenol plus suspensions, Motrin infant drops, children's Motrin suspensions, children's Zyrtec liquid in bottles, children's Benadryl allergy liquid, and many more. When you have recall of this many compounds, don't you think there is a very significant problem that's going on? So it isn't just a matter of the fact that it's drugs that are being put out by pharmaceutical houses and supposedly regulated by the FDA, but you know, what about the Tylenol recall that came because of musty smells? There were 271 medications that were impacted by the recall from Johnson & Johnson. And so, you know, nausea, stomach pain, vomiting, and diarrhea, you go, well, I was already sick, without realizing, in fact, that it was the musty Tylenol that created that problem. And by the way, if you think Johnson & Johnson's just a bunch of good old boys, and what's true is that, you know, stuff happens. As they say, stuff happens. Somehow, not only that whole list, but the Tylenol arthritis pain caplets and the Benadryl allergy tablets and the extra strength Tylenol gel and the Rolaids and the St. Joseph's aspirin. St. Joseph wouldn't do that to you. But it turns out that all of those things were recalled. 53 million bottles of medication were recalled. Would have been 53 million in one, except you cracked the lid and took yours. But we know Johnson & Johnson, they're really good guys. They would do everything right. But it turns out that last month, they didn't deliver any of the documents that were requested by the Congressional Committee investigating recent drug recalls. They just didn't make the deadline. That's a month ago today. So they're under scrutiny. But even when a congressional committee says you need to show up with these documents, well, they didn't have them because what they did, it was so sweet. What they did is they hired contractors, and they hired contractors to go out in the marketplace and buy these things that were on the shelf. They were supposed to, the document actually said that the contractors were to, quote, act like a regular customer in making the purchases. So rather than dealing with their own recall, they hired outside contractors to buy the product in the store. Yeah, they're a terrific bunch of guys, aren't they? This is a report that's 2 weeks old. So Motrin got repurchased by Johnson & Johnson because the drugs weren't dissolving properly. And you say, well, Eve, that's not really a big deal. But look at the list that I'm giving you. Look what happens if you cut your foot at the beach this week and you got a dreadful infection. And they decided that what you needed to do was to get a shot. And you were going to get a shot of something like Cipro. Pretty much everybody's heard of Cipro as an antibiotic, but it turns out the injectable versions of Cipro were recalled. So we want to look at the fact that this is a really big list. And this is a really big list in all sorts of categories. You know, when we look at a drug like Seroquel, Seroquel is kind of a new breed of medicine. It's known as an atypical antipsychotic. And what we have found out about Seroquel is for a long time, it's been known that it can create problems just like very many other psychoactive drugs can create. But now we find out that it has an increased rate at the onset of diabetes. So I can give you a drug that's going to help your psychological issues and at the same time increase your risk of diabetes. And then, guess what? I can sell you Avandia. So, you know, to inform the potential customers about the dangers, well, that's the duty of the manufacturer, in this case, AstraZeneca. But if you fail to provide sufficient warnings, as requested by the FDA, then the company gives the impression that they're more concerned with profit than they are with protecting patients for the possible dangers. Now, I don't want any of you to stop taking Seroquel. You need to consult your physician, because these are drugs that require mediation in terms of withdrawal. But what you want to understand is we're talking about everything from birth control pills to stomach acid drugs, from weight loss products to antipsychotics, from kids' Tylenol and Benadryl, all the way through the list. And we can go on. I mean, don't forget Bextra and Vioxx killed a whole lot of people before they were taken off the market. You know, we don't have to really look far. You know, we can look at Paxil being used in pregnancy and the babies that were born with a defect as a result of the mother. And, I mean, my heart goes out to this mother. You know, I've got a mother who's pregnant and she's depressed. And so they put her on Paxil. And then she's got a baby born with a birth defect. You don't even want to hear me say anything about what it is on the air. So when we look at this list, it's a pretty strong list. And it's a strong list of things that go all the way down to the drugstore items like Hydroxycut. You know, we're going to use this and we're going to get slim and lean and tight. I think the issue is really deep, because the issue has to do with us being hoodwinked. It has to do with us continuing to believe that we can spend 50 or 70 or 80 years breaking all the rules that there are about taking care of our own body, and then believing that some magic fairy at the pharmaceutical company is going to have that magic pill and it's going to straighten everything out and we're going to live happily ever after. So start where the starting is good. Realize that 50% of the problems that happen in your body, that first headache, that first upset stomach, that first bout of diarrhea, that first pain that you had in your little finger, may actually have to do with what you've done in the prior 24 hours. Not just what you ate, but what you got exposed to. You know, you put in those new carpets and you're breathing that stuff. You work down in the yard and you use pesticide, you're breathing that stuff. You slept in the room that you just painted today. You're breathing that stuff. It doesn't all have to come from the plate. When you look at anything that causes your body dysfunction, document it. Take out a piece of paper and write down on that paper, Monday, 12 July, woke up with a headache. Then write down, ate dinner at 7 o'clock Sunday night, had blah, 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 blah. What I had for lunch, back up during the day. See if you can find a relationship. We just had a client in the clinic that bought new pillows. You know those memory foam kind of pillows? Bought new pillows. Woke up every morning with a headache. Took 5 days until they went, gee, I wonder if it's the gas off on the pillow. Just went back to their old pillow, hadn't thrown it out, stuffed it in the closet, woke up the next day, didn't have a headache. They said, what should I do? Well, I said, well, stick the pillow in the garage for a month and let it gas off. We're getting compounds that are coming from the manufacturing of that foam that are toxic. So in a perfect world, no, we don't use the pillow, but this client wasn't willing to hear that story. Not after they went out and spent $50 for a fancy pillow. So the best thing that I can do is say, leave it in the garage for a month. And at the end of the month, try sleeping. And if you get a headache again, well, you know, the rest of the story. But if you would simply look in a rearview mirror and document what it was you did in the prior 24 hours, you might find the trigger for that headache. You might find the trigger for that reflux. You might find the trigger for that joint pain. And you say, well, Eve, I can understand how it could be related to a headache, and I can understand how it could be related to reflux, but I don't understand how it could be related to joint pain. You got to understand that everybody has different places in their body that are sensitive to the exposure to a toxic agent. It isn't going to manifest in everybody in the same way. You know, what's a total surprise to me, even after I'd been in practice for 20 years, was realizing how much dehydration had to do with pain. The first thing I want to tell anybody when they have a headache is go get a drink of water. Yeah, just drink a glass of water. And you go, you don't take a pill with it? You don't take an aspirin or an ibuprofen or an acetaminophen or an naproxen? And I go, no, just drink a glass of water. Start right there. Dehydration alone can create regional pain. And then if the headache continues, you always want to do the ice test. Put ice on your head. Put ice on the back of your neck. The reason that I say the back and the sides of your neck is that's where the arteries are that feed your brain. You have two arteries up the side of your neck, your carotids, everybody's heard of those, and two up the back of your neck, your basilar arteries. And if you cool those four arteries, you know those neck pillows you stick in the microwave and heat up? Well, you can take those neck pillows and you can put them in the freezer too. But you create something like that that contours around the back and the side of the neck that cools those four vertebrae. Because if you have a vasodilator headache, then when you put ice on it, the ice will cause it to vasoconstrict and you'll get relief, and you'll get relief right away. I'm not saying it's going to be 100% relieved, but you're going to find out at least if it's a vasodilator or a vasoconstrictor. Because if you have a vasoconstrictor headache and you put ice on it, you're going to make it worse. In which case, you need to go stand in the shower and bake your neck with hot water. You know how many headaches could be relieved by nothing more than drinking a glass of water and putting ice or heat on the back of the neck? I would say better than 70% of them. And you might say, well, Eve, I'm at work and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I can't exactly leave and go take a shower. No, but you sure as heck can look in the rearview mirror and see that when you ate that, you know, big old bag of Doritos or whatever with all of that salt in it, that it caused you to be vasoconstricted. Salt shrinks. So it vasoconstricts. And I can't believe that you can't find a mug that you put a hot cup of tea or coffee in at work, and you can't just hold that mug against the side of your and the back of your neck. I mean, there's got to be a way for you to find a solution other than always thinking that a pill is going to solve your problem. You get reflux. What the heck did you eat? And when did you eat it? Write it down. Got the reflux at 9:30, ate blah, blah, blah at 6:30, ate blah, blah, blah at 4 o'clock. Give yourself a documentation. The next time you get reflux, look at that list. If you find out that every time you go to the barbecue joint and you have that meal, you end up with heartburn, well, duh. You know, I mean, you don't need a pill. You need to stop eating that particular combination of food. It's called being self-responsible. We always want a magic bullet. We are cultured in America that we're not allowed to get sick. We have to keep producing. We want a fast pain relief. We want instant drying paint. We want drive-through banking. You know, we want anything that gives us immediate satisfaction. The idea of delayed reward is not common for Americans in general. And so while it's true that there are times for the use of those drugs, there are times, especially when somebody is well into the trimesters of their life, that systems start to break down. I mean, ultimately, it's true. We all get old. We all get sick. We're all going to die. And at some point, something isn't going to work. And we're going to be happy that there are certain meds that are there that are going to keep us glued together in that chapter. So believe me, I'm not anti-drug by any stretch of the imagination. But I think that we have to change our psychology in terms of asking for it. You know, when I saw the announcement in the paper last week that said that new regulations are going to be put out about the amount of antibiotics that are used in livestock. And I was thrilled to see that, because the inordinate amount of antibiotics that are used to treat livestock in this country are contributing to the antibiotic resistance that we're seeing in humans. But on the very same day that I read that article, I had a parent that came in and said that she had taken her child to the pediatrician that morning because the kid had a cough, and the pediatrician had written a script for an antibiotic. And I asked one simple question. I said, how many minutes were you in the room with the physician? And she said, less than three. So in less than 3 minutes, this doctor heard this kid go and wrote a script for an antibiotic. We can turn around and create bacterial resistance when we're using these antibiotics indiscriminately. So it's this indiscriminate psychology, this idea that we simply match the pill to the pain, and that there's no repercussion that comes from that. You know, if I look at the failure to do anything agency, the FDA, and I realize that there were lots of promises that were made by this administration to make a change. You know, fundamentally, the prior administration presided over and really fostered the abdication on the part of their agencies, these agencies, like the FDA, of their duty to protect us. No, it's not all one administration's fault, but I'm simply hoping that the additional resources to hire more federal food prosecutors and more regulation on the background, the financial conflicts of doctors who conduct clinical trials on drugs and medical devices in human subjects, that is more stringently regulated under this administration. You know, we have to restore science to its rightful place. You know, when I look at the hijackers that we've had, the science hijackers, you know, the climate change deniers and such, I see the same thing that's happened in pharmaceuticals. I see the same thing that's happened in terms of the EPA. You know, the EPA has repeatedly failed to protect us as well. You know, when I found out when I was up in Virginia in April teaching that there was actually a golf course there, and the EPA allowed the fly ash that came from, coal ash. You know, we keep thinking that there really is a term called clean coal, but, you know, coal-fired plants are the largest industrial source of mercury pollution in the country. I mean, forget about eating tuna. It's coal-fired plants that are giving us the mercury. So the EPA doesn't even bother to regulate coal ash as a hazardous substance. So while I was up in Virginia, it turned around that they sculpted a golf course with 1.5 million tons of this ash, the very same one that was involved in that catastrophic Tennessee spill. And now the golf course has contaminated the groundwater with lead and arsenic and other contaminants. So believe me, the FDA is not the only one that I've got a target on. The EPA gets to stand in line. But what I'm hoping is in my lifetime, and what I'm actually hoping is in this decade, that the FDA would stand for finally daring to act, because I'm just as sick as you are about reading about these things. And so I'm asking you to think about pharmaceuticals in a different light, to think about them in such a way that you realize that there are some inherent dangers there.